Just a word about Sunday evening for us. Our Sunday services, actually all of our church services, are really developed like a balanced menu. We try to think about what are the things that are necessary from the scriptures for the life of a church and a healthy Christian, and certainly at the heart of that is worship. Our Sunday morning service is all about looking up. But that's only one element of growing in Christ and pleasing Christ, being His kind of people. We also need to be connected with each other and understand relationally how to encourage each other to grow in Christ. So Sunday school, Wednesday night, there's a lot of that type of thing taking place in small group settings. But between the large corporate gathering where we look up and then the small groups, there's this piece that I like to think of as church life, congregational life, understanding how the congregation, by God's design, is to function. And that's really what Sunday evening is all about for us. Sunday evening, we take time to think about the ministries of the church, church-wide, not just what's happening in your little group of people, you know, but what is God doing outside of your little group? What's He doing in the church at large, and even beyond the local church at times? So we take time to think about missions and what God's doing in missions, missionaries coming. Take time to pray about ministries that are happening here and around the world. We do a variety of things to help us pray for those ministries. I say that because this month is a significant month for us as we think about some things like that. Next week, as we go out to the camp for the evening service, as we fellowship with a sister church. 2 weeks from now, you won't want to miss, we're going to be having Steve Sark with us. Steve is a missionary back from China. He has been serving with the Tibetans in the western side of China for several years, and we're going to be hearing some incredible things about what God's doing in that part of the world that we don't hear a lot about. So Steve will be with us on the 10th. On the 17th, Sunday, we'll be having a special day where we focus on answers in Genesis with Bob Gillespie as a special speaker for Sunday school. Sunday morning and Sunday evening, he'll be preaching the three messages. He'll actually be with you at the camp then for family camp. And then we also are looking forward for special music that evening to have the Shepherd's Handbell Choir with us. So there's going to be some special things happening this month, and we'll look forward to growing as a church family, growing as in our understanding of what God is doing in His church here and even beyond here. You continue to have lessons that you see us learning together as a church. I'm thinking particularly of the summer staff, as we have things that aren't planned that happen, such as this morning again, our friend was back, and hopefully you could explain to your families a little bit what I told you last Sunday evening about what happened in the service last week and happened again this morning. Several of our people had good conversations with our guest afterwards. Thank you for praying also about our brother, our friend that I told you about last week, our Chinese brother that is interested in salvation and baptism. We actually had a good time with him this morning, and Zhang, is that his name? Zhang helped with translation. That was really, really good, and we were able to just talk with this man about what it means to be a Christian, and he's real interested in being baptized, so you'll be hearing more from him as that takes place. And in fact, you'll be seeing in the bulletin next week those who are interested in baptism or church membership. This is a great time to let us know about that. There'll be a sign up because we'll be having our next new members class here real soon. All right, well, now let's turn to the book of Daniel. I want to begin just by doing a little reflecting. My grandmother was one of eight children. She used to tell me stories about her life as a child growing up on a farm in Guernsey County. Anybody from Guernsey County? All right, there you go. That's my roots, way back. Predates me, but that's where they were planted. She grew up there many years ago, the early 1900s, no television. No car at first, no telephone in the house, let alone a cell phone, no electric or gas oven, no microwave, no Pop-Tarts, no frozen pizzas, no ragu spaghetti in a jar. In her 9 decades of life, she saw changes that we used to talk about. I mean, just incredible changes. Some of you that are a little further along than I am will remember some of those changes. I remember some of them, but not the ones I just mentioned. By the time she died, which was a few years ago now, she had not only left Guernsey County and traveled outside of Guernsey County, but she actually got on an airplane and flew to Israel for a trip once. So she saw some incredible changes in her life. Well, the world is really changing. I mean, it's really changing now. It seems like it's at warp speed in many different ways. And we often wonder, where is it all heading with these changes happening? Where is this world heading? And what I want to do tonight is part two of what we began last week. One of the things we do on Sunday nights as well is try to address specific subjects that we need to know about as God's people. And in this case, it's the question, where is the world heading? We have a natural curiosity about that question, and God has addressed that question for us in his Word. I specifically would narrow the focus down a little bit to think about where are things heading as it relates to the Middle East. As you know, in 1948, the nation of Israel was reestablished in a land after 19 centuries of a diaspora. Since then, the tension has only increased. And obviously, the question is, could what is happening today in the Middle East be evidence that we are living in the last days? And I certainly would lean in that direction. Now, there's a lot we don't know about the end times. But God has told us everything He wants us to know about the end times in His Word, which is sufficient for our life. And there are a lot of places we could look to learn about what's coming and what God has said about what's coming. But we want to focus our attention tonight on the second passage we're looking at in Daniel. Last time we looked in chapter 9. Tonight we look at chapter 11. The prophet Daniel was a man of God, and you read the biographical section of Daniel's life in the first six chapters of the book. He was a man that God privileged also to have a preview of world events, what was coming, through a series of four visions that he recorded in chapters 10, 11, and 12. In the fourth vision, which is the most detailed of Daniel's visions, God revealed to Daniel what was going to happen from Daniel's day in the 6th century B.C., which was when he lived, all the way to the climax of the end time. The first section of chapter 11, which as you scan through it is verses 1 to 20, though future for Daniel, is actually history for us now. It's already happened. It's the prophetic record of what happened from roughly 535 B.C. to 175 B.C. Then the second section of chapter 11, which is verses 21 to 35, we find a detailed prediction of the reign of what is now a historical figure to us, a man by the name of, which was actually a title, Antiochus IV Epiphanes, the wicked, God-hating, Jew-hating Syrian ruler that plagued the world in the 2nd century B.C. So that prediction was given through Daniel. He's coming for him, for us now. He's past tense. But the final section of this vision, which is verses 36 to 45, where we're going to look tonight, is both climactic and controversial. We're told about a ruler in verse 36. In fact, I'll read it. The king will do as he pleases. He will exalt and magnify himself above every god and will say unheard of things against the God of gods. This king will do as he pleases, we're told. Who is this king? Well, we're not for sure. In fact, before we plunge into this passage, let me talk about some possible interpretations. Bible scholars have laid before us three suggestions as to who this is and what's happening in this section that we're looking at, verses 36 to 45. One interpretation is to say it's already happened. That is, this wicked ruler described in these verses is a continuation of Antiochus Epiphanes, the one that we saw in the previous section that I mentioned. And so this section then is just more history to us, although it was future to Daniel when he wrote it. The second view says, no, it's not history, it's yet to happen. It's completely future. Not just future for Daniel, but future even for us. This view says that this is not history at all, and it's not a historical figure at all, but a future character, the coming Antichrist. Luther, for instance, identified him as the Antichrist. Jerome in 400 AD commented, and I quote, "The Jews believe that this passage is referred to Antichrist. We too understand this to refer to the Antichrist." A third view mixes the two, and the third view says it mingles both the past and the future. Remember, the term past is, I'm using it relatively, because it was all future to Daniel. When he's writing this down, none of it had happened yet. Antiochus was still future. The whole section was future to Daniel. Antiochus did come. He was a wicked, evil, historical leader. And he was also a foreshadowing of a yet future, evilest of all leaders, a person the Bible refers to as the Antichrist. Now, here's where the confusion enters. Verse 35 is clearly referring to the events during the days of Antiochus. Verse 36 seems to continue speaking of Antiochus when it says, "And the king will do according to his will," King James says. But then it goes on and says some things that don't sound at all like Antiochus based on what we know from history. Some of the details sound like him, but some of them, quite frankly, do not. For instance, verse 36 says, "He will magnify himself above every god." Well, Antiochus, though a great blasphemer, did not place a statue of himself, but of Zeus Olympus in the Jerusalem temple. Another detail that doesn't fit Antiochus is in verse 37, which says, "He will have no regard for the gods of his fathers." But to the contrary, Antiochus's policy was to force Jewish subjects to worship the God of his fathers or be killed. So, what's going on in Daniel chapter 11? The answer, apparently, and I take the third view, is that it's mingling the past and the future. One commentator puts it this way: biblical prophecy regularly exhibits the characteristics of telescoping the future, so that the more distant event appears to merge with the near so as to become indistinguishable from it. I like that word picture. Think of a telescope. When the telescope is in, it has a different perspective than when the parts have been extended. And so Daniel's looking at the telescope as it's in, but as time passed, the telescope is pulled apart, and what looked to him like the end was actually the beginning of another section, something that was coming later. The best-known passage in which we see this telescoping, and it's not just here, would be Jesus' teaching in Matthew 24, the parallel passage in Mark 13. Where Jesus speaks both of the coming fall of Jerusalem, which to us is now past, it happened. What Jesus said was coming, the fall of Jerusalem, actually happened in AD 70 when the Romans came. But he mingles that coming fall of Jerusalem, which obviously has already happened now, to other things in that passage which are at least 1900 years removed because they still haven't happened even in our day, by our day. And Jesus doesn't clearly distinguish which ones are coming sooner in the future and later in the future. He just lumps them together. Well, the point for us is this: Daniel 11 seems to be doing that. And Daniel 11 is not interested in giving us a timeline per se, something that we can chart out and figure out exactly what's happening in that fashion, but simply giving to the people of God an understanding of where is this world heading. And from this prophecy revealed in Daniel 11, verses 36 to 45, there are two end time specifics that Daniel received by way of revelation and wrote down for the edification of the people of God. The first thing we're going to see, verses 36 to 39, are the end time conditions. And then we're going to see in verses 40 to 45 the end time conflict. The conditions that will be in the end, and the conflict that will take place. Now let's look at the end time conditions. There are two end time conditions that Daniel points out to us as revealed to him. First, he points out that there's going to be a final world ruler. Now let's read his description again from verse 36 with some comments along the way. The king will do as he pleases. The King James says he will do according to his will. He will exalt and magnify himself above every god and will say unheard of things. King James says he will say marvelous things. Against the God of gods, he will be successful until the time of wrath is completed, or as the King James puts it, and shall prosper till the indignation be accomplished. For what has been determined must take place. The Apostle John refers to him as the Antichrist in his epistles, for instance, 1 John 2:18, or the beast from the sea in Revelation 13:1 and Revelation 17:1-18. Paul refers to this same figure as the man of sin in 2 Thessalonians 2, verse 3 and verse 4 and verses 8 to 10. In Daniel chapter 7, verse 24, he's referred to as the little horn. In Daniel 8, verses 23 to 25, he's referred to as the king of fierce countenance. Different ways the Bible uses to describe this end time figure who will be a rival against God and God's people. Now we're told a couple of his characteristics in our passage. We're told, number one, he will be totally obsessed with himself. He will, the text says, do as he pleases. And says he will exalt himself. Notice that. He will magnify himself to the point that in his presumption he will claim to be above every god, thus asserting himself to be God. Now, let me remind you that according to Genesis 3:5, this is the root of all sin, human sin included. We sin because we want to call the shots. We want to be God in life. The difference between us and this ruler is that he will have the power to work out his egotistic pretensions. He will magnify himself, and he will have power to go along with that egotism. So, what are his characteristics? This final ruler will be obsessed with himself, and then we're told he will blaspheme God. He will promote a very anti-true God campaign. He will speak, the text says, against the God of gods. Will Rogers once remarked that there were two eras in American history, the passing of the buffalo and the passing of the buck, as he used to say. Someone has said, to err is human, to blame it on the divine is even more human. And that's the picture of what we see here. We see a powerful person who's going to turn people against the true and living God. Happens all the time now. People will blame things on God. That's the height of human arrogance, to blame things on God. This man will not just blame it on God. He will blaspheme God in his attempt to usurp the authority of God in the place of God. Now, how is it that an ungodly, God-defying ruler like this man will be able to succeed in his pursuits? The answer is the same one that the Bible gives of ungodly people who are, in a smaller sense, doing the same thing in our world right now, promoting their godless, self-centered agenda, walking all over God's people, not caring. And the biblical answer to how to make sense of this is just simply, their day is coming. Their day is coming. They're not getting away with anything. Nothing is missing the gaze of the sovereign Lord in His world. And here he wants us to know that the day of this most wicked of rulers is coming. God will deal with him. Verse 36 makes that very clear, that this coming ruler's heyday will come to an end. It says there, notice, he will be successful, and then there's the word, until the time of wrath is completed, for what has been determined must take place. So this ruler who's coming is living on borrowed time. He has his leash. He's on a leash. He can't do whatever he wants. He's on a leash. He's on borrowed time. God alone is sovereign. God is not in heaven wondering, how am I going to get this thing back under control in the world I created? He told us ahead of time where it's heading and what he's going to do about it. He shall prosper, this man shall, only until the day of God's wrath, the period referred to as the time of Jacob's trouble, Jeremiah 30 and verse 7, is fulfilled. I don't know how this fits into your idea of God or your idea of how God works, but the truth of the matter is on the scriptures, God is absolutely sovereign even over evil and evil things that happen in his universe. He doesn't cause evil, but he's in control over everything that happens. He even can use and will use the Antichrist in that day, just like he used Antiochus Epiphanes in previous days to scourge his wayward people and to accomplish things to prepare for his glory in the eternal state. God's plan is certain. Now, there's a second end time condition that we find beginning in verse 37. The first is that there will be a final world ruler. And then secondly, there's going to be a final world religion. What exactly will this final world ruler do? He will set up a world religion that is described in verses 37 to 39. You can follow, but let me read from the Living Bible paraphrase that section. He will have no regard for the gods of his fathers, nor for the God beloved of women, nor any other god, for he will boast that he's greater than them all. Instead of these, he will worship the fortress god, a god his fathers never knew, and lavish on him costly gifts. Claiming his help, he will have great success against the strongest fortresses. He will honor those who submit to him, appointing them to positions of authority and dividing the land to them as their reward. Now, isn't it interesting, as you just listen to that, this final rule of this final world ruler has a lot of religious overtones to it. What kind of world religion will he install and will he endorse? It's going to be characterized by three things described in our passage. First, it will be described, let me just give them to you and then we'll just develop them. Here's the big picture. This final world religion will be characterized by modernism, by materialism, and by militarism. First of all, modernism. Verse 37 says, he will show no regard for the gods of his fathers. He will be like Stalin. In this sense, Stalin began as a candidate for the priesthood in the Russian Orthodox Church before defecting to Marxism and atheism, and then history verifies that his brutal oppression followed that. This coming ruler will be a non-traditionalist who will abandon the gods of his fathers and show no regard for, and this is very interesting, the text says no regard for the desire of women. What does that phrase imply? Who's the desire of women? One suggestion is that the desire of women refers to Tammuz, whose cult was popular in ancient Syria, especially among women, the desire of women. It was a cult-type situation, a cultus deity. But another interpretation, I think fits better, especially in light of Daniel's Jewish background, is the one that's suggested by John Wolvard in his commentary, and that is, he develops, as Wolvard, that the natural desire of Jewish women was to be the mother of the promised Messiah. This was a natural desire. God had predicted to the Jews that the Messiah was coming, and it was the anticipation of a Jewish woman for centuries to have that honor, to be able to be the mother of the Messiah for the people of God. The seed promised to the woman in Genesis 3:5. And so the expression, the desire of women, became a symbol of the messianic hope in general. In other words, this is a text that's looking ahead to the Messiah, to Jesus. We know from history now that's Jesus that's in view here. So this future leader will not only hate God, but he will hate God's anointed one, his own son. And what's more, not only will he downplay the messianic hope, he will seek to eliminate any honor given to the Messiah. This is going to be a Christless, man-centered religion. That's why I use the term modernism. Modernism, and we've seen it in the last century in our country and around the world. We were praying for East, or Western Europe, modernism has completely sucked the life out of true Christianity in Western Europe, and it's happening in our country as well. Modernism keeps the shell of Christianity, the shell of religion, but just sucks out the life from it. That's what this man's going to do. Characterized by modernism. Secondly, his rule will be characterized by materialism. Verse 38, instead of them, the text says, he will honor a god of fortresses, a god unknown to his fathers. He will honor with, here it is, gold and silver, with precious stones and costly gifts. Now, there's no evidence that Antiochus ever went that far in his rule in the 2nd century or so B.C. This verse is describing a man who will eliminate all previous gods, save the only his own, the one he promotes as the right one, and it's called the God of Fortresses here. The God of Fortresses, it seems, is not a person, but a power to make war, as symbolized by the term fortress. Simply put, the only thing that this ruler trusts is himself and his own military power. John Wolvert observes, he is a complete materialist in contrast to all previous religions and all previous men who claim divine qualities. This is blasphemy to the ultimate, the exaltation of human power and attainment. He is Satan's masterpiece, a human being who is Satan's substitute for Jesus Christ, hence properly identified as the Antichrist. So materialism to go along with his modernism, and then there will be a rule characterized by brutal militarism. Verse 39 describes his assault, saying he will attack the mightiest fortresses with the help of a foreign god, probably with reference to demonic assistance, and will greatly honor those who acknowledge him. He will make them rulers over many people and will distribute the lands at a price. The final world religion of the Antichrist then will be a combination of modernism and materialism and militarism. His only god will be might. His will be totalitarian, and his rule will be absolute. And right, what's his might will make what's right. He will attack everyone who stands in his way, and he will reward those and reward them handsomely if they side with him. Now, this is a prophecy God gave to Daniel about what's coming in the future at the end. My friends, these will be the end time conditions. There will be a final world ruler and a final world religion. Lest we be unnerved, may I remind you that God is not intimidated at all by pagan leaders, nor will he be intimidated at all by this final pagan, godless, God-defying leader. In fact, let me just share a little illustration. Sometimes when things are not clear, it's always good to go back and affirm what is clear. And there's a story about an old music teacher that was asked in greeting, "What's the good news today?" And the old man, without saying a word, walked across the room, picked up a tuning fork, struck it, and as the note sounded, he said, "That is A. It is A today. It was A 5,000 years ago. It will be A 10,000 years from now. The sopranist upstairs sings off key. The tenor across the hall is out of tune." He struck the note again and said, "That is A, my friend, and that is the good news today." What do you know for sure? When things are happening that you don't know, it's good to know what you know, and what you know is true. The good news today and for all eternity is this: God is in control, and God, who's in control, has told us where things are heading. He's told us that there will be a rival to him, that there will be a rival religion, so that his people can be prepared for it, so that his people, not to be unnerved by it, but can be prepared for it and follow him faithfully no matter what they must go through. He revealed to Daniel, what, 25 centuries ago now, what's going to happen in the world. Well, those are the end time conditions. in verses 36 to 39. Now let's take a look at the end time conflict and the time that we have left here, and that's in verses 40 to 45. Now, we might conjecture, as I mentioned, about the references in verses 36 to 39, whether they pertain to Antiochus or at least in part to Antiochus or to the final world ruler and how that relates. But most commentators agree that there's a definite transition in verse 40. Verse 40 begins and says, at the time of the end. And the final verses of Daniel 11 deal with this massive end-time conflict, and they give a picture of the strategy of the coming Antichrist. And we'll see five phases that characterize this conflict that will be instigated by this wicked ruler. We see his aggression, first of all, in verse 40. Now remember, God sent an angel, and he's been speaking to Daniel since chapter 10, verse 20. And now in verse 40, he begins to describe, of chapter, our text, he begins to describe a massive war effort that will occur to the end. And I read verse 40, at the time of the end, the king of the south will engage him in battle. Hit the pause button for a moment. In section 1, this king of the south appears to be a reference to Egypt. Perhaps here to a block of nations allied with Egypt, including Libya and Nubia or Sudan, referred to in verse 43. Now, continue the reading. At the time of the end, the king of the south will engage him in battle, and the king of the north will storm out against him with chariots and cavalry and a great fleet of ships. Now, this king of the north perhaps refers to a Syrian coalition. Archer suggests a league of Middle Eastern nations. So you've got this coalition from the south, you've got this coalition of nations from the north. The text continues and says, he will invade many countries and sweep through them like a flood. Now, at this point, speculation begins to abound when you're reading the commentaries. One suggestion is that this king of the north points to a Russian leader, since Russia lies to the far north of Israel with Moscow situated at nearly the same longitude. I will say this, when I travel to Eastern Europe and I'm interacting with my dear brothers there in Ukraine, and I see on their shelves these American books that have been sent over, particularly end of the world eschatology books on their shelves that talk about these Americans saying that the Russians are the enemy and that they are the ones that are going to be destroyed. It does create some awkward moments for us as we're relating to our brothers and sisters there in the former Soviet Union. Now, some believe that's what that's referring to, and it may well be. Another suggests that this will be an Italian leader, the little horn who comes out of the Roman Empire, mentioned in chapter 9, verse 26. Whoever it will be is uncertain to us, but there can be no denying his aggression. He will, the text says, invade many countries and sweep through them like a flood. The terminology reminds us of the blitzkrieg warfare that brought the Nazi success early on in World War II. So verse 40 describes this conflict beginning with aggression. It also describes in the next phase, verse 41, tremendous anti-Semitism. It says, he will also invade the beautiful, or King James says, the glorious land. The beautiful land is a reference, it seems to me, to Israel. The beautiful land, the chosen people's land. He will invade the beautiful land. Many countries will fall, but Edom, Moab, and the leaders of Ammon will be delivered from his hand. This coming conflict is going to be horrible for the Jewish people. In fact, verse 45 reveals that the Antichrist will pitch his royal tents right in the midst of the promised land, as the text says, at the beautiful holy mountain. Drop down and notice in verse 1 of chapter 12, where we're given a specific indicator of the coming severity of this anti-Semitism. Verse 1, chapter 12, at that time Michael, the great prince who protects your people, he's writing to Daniel, your people, that's the Jewish people. A great the great prince who protects your people will arise. There will be a time of distress, as has not happened from the beginning of nations until then. But at that time, your people, everyone who is found written in the book, will be delivered. Now, that's incredible when you think about what the Jewish people have been through already in world history. I mean, talk about aggressors, from Haman to Hitler, from Antiochus to Stalin. And why such aggression against the Jewish people? Well, for two basic reasons. The first is that centuries ago, God chose that nation to be His peculiar people. But because of their waywardness, He is now using the deeds of pagan nations to restore them and get their attention. The second reason is that the Jews have suffered such abuse is this: a world that is hostile against God will inevitably and naturally be hostile against God's people. And that has been the case ever since God entered into this covenant relationship with the descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Anti-Semitism is a grievous thing. Sadly, this deadly cancer, which will express itself fully under the Antichrist, is festering and spreading in our day. And it's spreading in our day more rapidly than I can even fathom. Some of you my age and older will remember when there was a time, not that long ago, when Israel was looked at quite favorably in our country. In 1980, I went and I lived in Israel, and there was a lot of pity for the Jewish people, the 6 million that had been slaughtered under Hitler, and there was a time when there was great appreciation for the Jewish people. They were given a land to live in. But you know as well as I do, all you have to do is watch the news now, and that favor of Israel is rapidly diminishing. There is a rapidly spreading anti-Semitic view in the world today. And you just need to be aware that it's happening. You need to be aware of where it's coming from and what God has said about it, even here in His Word. We see in the third phase there will be tremendous ambition being demonstrated by this world ruler and his attack against God and His people. Ambition is an ugly thing, and when it's particularly demonstrated by somebody that has power and might. Just to illustrate that, not wanting to be too political, but here's a good illustration of how this, when you get ambition in the hands of somebody that has power, what it looks like. Charles Colson, in his book Kingdoms in Conflict, tells how he would influence diverse interest groups through White House visits to ensure that then President Nixon would be reelected. Of course, Colson was later saved, the founder of Prison Fellowship Ministries. But this is back before he was a believer. He was President Nixon's hatchet man. And he talks about how he would escort guests past saluting guards and down a long corridor with dramatic photographs of the president in action. Now, picture this. It was his job to take those that had complaints against the president of the United States and prepare them now for a meeting with the president. And here's how he did it. He would escort them past these saluting guards, past the pictures of the president in action. Then he would pause at the executive dining room and point to the door at the right and say in hushed tones, "That's the Situation Room." The legendary super secret National Security Nerve Center. And he writes, "Actually, it was just a crowded office. The real command center had been moved to the Pentagon." Next, if the visitors seemed unsupportive of the president, Colson would treat them for a walk upstairs to the Oval Office. If the president was there, Colson would ask, always by prearrangement, if the visitor would like to see the president. Colson writes, "Nixon was a master at the game. He always gave his dazzled visitor gold-plated cufflinks with the presidential seal. The person would be overwhelmed as he left, almost bowing, not more than 60 seconds later." And then Colson says, "It's not easy to resist the allure of the Oval Office. Invariably, the lions of the waiting room became the lambs of the Oval Office. No one ever showed outward hostility. Most, except the labor leaders, forgot their best rehearsed lines. They nodded when the president spoke, and in those rare instances when they disagreed, they did so apologetically, assuring the president that they personally respected his opinion. Ironically, none, think about this, ironically, Colson says, none were more compliant than the religious leaders. Of all people, they should have been the most aware of the sinful nature of man and the least overwhelmed by pomp and protocol. But theological knowledge sometimes wilts in the face of worldly power. End of quote. Let me read that again. Theological knowledge sometimes wilts in the face of worldly power. Ambition is a blinding force. This coming Antichrist is going to be a master manipulator. Now, what will drive him? Well, his ambition will be twofold. One, it'll be his desire for power and his desire for money, both referred to in this text. Verse 42 says, he will extend his power over many countries. Egypt will not escape. And verse 43 says, he will gain control of the treasures of gold and silver and all the riches of Egypt with the Libyans and Nubians in submission. Power and money. Money and power. These are the twins that drive many a leader in our day too. And if let's be honest with ourselves, these are the things that often drive our own hearts and the things that we're after, and our ambitions are triggered by the desire to be in control, at least in control of our little world, and to have security, money, and all that goes along with that. And then not only do we see his ambition, but we see fourthly his alarm in verse 44. The tide begins to change in verse 44. But reports from the east and the north will alarm him, and he will set out in great rage to destroy and annihilate many. Walvoord suggests the tidings of the east probably refers to the gigantic invasion described in Revelation 9, verses 13 to 21, where we're told an army of 200 million men will cross the Euphrates and descend on the Holy Land. Lest that number stagger us as impossible, please realize that China alone claims to have a militia numbering in excess of 200 million in our day. Then we see his, and by the way, I'm not saying that that's who this is, but just the size of an army, it's there. And then we see his abdication in verse 45. The final words of verse 45 are telling. It says, he will pitch his royal tents between the seas at the beautiful holy mountain, yet he will come to his end, and no one will help him. So reads the end of this wicked ruler and his attempt to attack God and his people. Now, Daniel 11 is not the only place in the Bible we're told about the Antichrist. As I mentioned, the Apostle John wrote about him. 1 John 2:18 says, you've heard that the Antichrist shall come. Paul describes the same person in 2 Thessalonians 2, verses 3 and 4. Don't let anyone deceive you in any way, says Paul, for that day will not come until the rebellion occurs and the man of lawlessness is revealed, the man doomed to destruction. He will oppose and exalt himself over everything that is called God or is worshipped, so that he sets himself up in God's temple, proclaiming himself to be God. No mere man will be a match for the Antichrist, but the Lord himself will bring him down, we're told in 2 Thessalonians 2:8, when it says, and then the lawless one will be revealed, whom the Lord Jesus will overthrow with the breath of his mouth and destroy by the splendor of his coming. So, that's what's coming. Daniel was given this vision of what's coming in the future to him, and it seems to me that a significant part of it is still future to us. Now, why does God want us to know this? Why does God want us to know where the world is heading? May I suggest three reasons as we pull this to a head and apply it to our own lives. Number one, he wants us to know that he has a plan for this world. He told us ahead of time so we wouldn't be surprised, so we wouldn't be alarmed. When we're reading in our newspapers and when we're watching on the news what's happening in the world, particularly in the Middle East, we ought not be surprised. He said that he was going to be using wicked rulers and even the ultimate wicked ruler to accomplish his purposes. He warned us that things are going to get bad, but we need not lose heart. Jesus says, "He who stands firm to the end will be saved," in Matthew 24, verse 13. Number two, he wants us to know that he has a plan for his people. And here, when I say his people, I'm thinking specifically of his covenant people, the Jewish people that he chose, through which he has brought into the world his son, through which he's established a new people known as the church. But he is not finished with this people. And Romans chapter 11 talks about how, in the analogy of the vine and the branches being cut off, how the branches can be grafted back in again. The time of the Gentiles is going to end with the destruction of the Antichrist. God has a purpose for his chosen people, the Jewish people. God obviously has a plan for you as an individual as well. In Daniel 11, he informs us what's going to happen to those who live for themselves, for those who dishonor him, for those who resist his plan. But he's also making it clear that he has a plan for those who follow him, those who trust him. So I ask you tonight, how are you, we've been thinking of this in the big world scale, but in your own life, are you living for the honor of God, or are you living for your own honor? Are you living for his agenda, or do you have your own agenda that you're interested in your life? In order to honor God in our lives, we must know the one that he sent into the world the first time, who's coming a second time. God sent his son into the world to rescue us. Our problem is that we are self-seeking sinners. And the penalty for our sin is eternal destruction. But Jesus Christ went to the cross and bore the penalty for our self-seeking, for our sin, so that we could be delivered from its penalty. We could be delivered from eternal destruction. Have you come to know Christ as your Savior? Have you put your trust in him? And have you surrendered your life to him and his purposes? He's conquered the grave. He's returned to heaven. He's returning to this earth and will rule and establish his rule over all the earth in his kingdom. A third reason for why God has told us what's going to happen, I think, is this. He wants us to live now in light of his plan. A general once sat at a table in a royal court, seated next to the court chaplain. And in the course of the meal, the general turned to the chaplain and, to make conversation, asked, "Pastor, in this moment together here, could you tell me something about heaven?" The court chaplain looked at him carefully and said, "Well, yes, I could. The first thing I would tell you, general, is that in heaven, you will not be a general." It's good to be reminded of that as we work our way through this life and we get impressed with ourselves. We read a passage like this and it reminds us of what's coming and who we really are. It will be different then for you and me as well. For when Jesus Christ returns, he will bring salvation for those who've believed in him, and he will bring judgment for those who have rejected him. Today is the day of salvation. I want us to close our time by doing a couple things like we did last week as we closed. I want to give you some time just to let this truth sink into your soul. And we're going to sing two songs that will help us think about what's coming. And the first is 243. If you want to take your book, and Joe is going to help us.